Welcome to Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written. Isaiah is this quarter's subject, a book with 66 chapters. There's a lot to get into, and I am glad we are joined by the author of this quarter's quarterly. He is Dr. Roy Gain from the Theological Seminary at Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Dr. Gain, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Pastor Bradshaw. It's good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. We're in Isaiah, and we begin this time around in Isaiah chapter 9. Before we go there, I'm going to read a couple of things that you included in the opening page of the Lesson Quarterly. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, who supervised the creation of the first atomic bomb, appeared before a U.S. congressional committee. They inquired of him if there were any defense against the weapon. Certainly, the great physicist replied. And that is... He looked over the audience and said softly, peace. Peace. That is the defense against the weapon. So we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 9. Sunday's lesson is entitled The End of Gloom for Galilee. I'm going to begin by reading, Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at the first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more grievously afflicted her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee in the nations. Verse 2, here we go. We start to really recognize these verses. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. I can hear Handel's Messiah being sung right now. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined, and so forth. And then we get down to verse 6, which we'll talk about in just a moment. This is really interesting. Nevertheless, or but why does Isaiah begin chapter 6 on that note?
All right. The translation could either be but or because, but probably a contrast like but. And no gloom for her who was in anguish, referring to a land and a people. Why does it refer to that? What is the contrast? The contrast is with the previous chapter, with the end of chapter 8, where it's speaking about people who inquire in 8 verse 19, who inquire of occult mediums and those kinds of people instead of consulting the Lord. They're consulting the wrong entity. They're inquiring of the dead on behalf of the living and so on. And so as a result, then they're greatly distressed, and they have in verse, right at the end of chapter 8, they look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, they'll be thrust into thick darkness, and then chapter 9, where you started. But there will be no gloom for who is in anguish. So what is going to bring about the change? There's going to be something that is going to be light. And already, when we look at the whole chapter, when we look at the passage and its historical context, we realize this is already messianic. This is already speaking about Jesus Christ. Because it says, it goes on and it says, in the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he's made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. This was the first part of the northern kingdom of Israel that was conquered by Assyria under Tiglath-Pileser III, after King Ahaz sent him a bribe to help Ahaz against northern Israel and Syria. The Assyrian armies moved in, and they took over this territory. Okay, so there was gloom. There was anguish. There was contempt for this area. But what do we find in Matthew chapter 4? Matthew chapter 4, speaking of Jesus' ministry, starting with verse 13. And leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. And then it quotes from exactly the passage we're reading in Isaiah. These people have seen a great light. And then it's in verse 17 of Matthew 4. From that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And that's right after quoting Isaiah 61, because 61 has something related, but it's quoting Isaiah 9, where it says, on them a light has dawned. And then Jesus says, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. That's the light. That's the good news. And Jesus went and specifically targeted that same place, which was the first to fall under the great empires, and he brought hope to that place first. And that's what Isaiah is speaking about here in chapter 9.
How should we relate to this where God has said, you've got some terrible things going on. There are occult practices. You've got a king who just died a few chapters earlier, and he started well but ended up as a scoundrel. Things aren't looking good. You've got terrible oppressive enemies surrounding you, but it's okay. There's a great day ahead. And then 700 or so years ahead of time, the birth of Jesus is predicted. Now, how was this? This is great comfort to us because we have the privilege of looking back over history and saying, oh, this is looking forward to the Christ and what a wonderful prophecy Christ was coming. But if I was living in Judah at the time and there was oppression and oppressors and there was a promise made of I should read it. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. I mean, I get it, but my question for you is, would I have got it if I was living in Isaiah's day? What would that have meant to me in terms of deliverance from oppression?
Well, if you just look at the profile of this individual, you see that in verse 7 of Isaiah 9, on the throne of David and over his kingdom. They could immediately relate to that because the people of Judah had the dynasty of David ruling over them. All of these kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, they were all from the line of David. And so they could relate to that. But there's something strange about this. Something strange because, for to us a child is born, okay? Obviously, he's going to be in the line of David, and he's going to be a ruler. The government will be on his shoulders, so he's going to be a ruler. But his name shall be called. Now, so it's not just like a proper name, but these are descriptive features which are indicating something about his nature. And when it says wonderful counselor, okay, that's great, But when you look at Judges chapter 13, you remember what happened when Manoah, the father of Samson, asked the angel, what is your name? And this angel, which was the angel of the Lord, said, my name is wonderful. It's from the same root. This is connecting really these two passages. Counselor, he's the one who gives wisdom. And this is exactly what the kings of Judah needed. And Isaiah was giving them from God was wisdom. But this is a wonderful counselor. He's going to be a king who is a counselor. He doesn't need a brilliant human counselor like David had Ahithophel and Hushai, you know, counselors. He is a counselor. He is a wise king. But then it says, mighty God. How is it possible that this king, this son of David, is in the dynasty of David, is called mighty God? He is a divine personality. And then it says, Everlasting Father. What could that possibly mean? How could he be the Father? He's the Son. How could he be the Father? And then Prince of Peace. Okay, that we can understand. When it says Everlasting Father, all of this adds up. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It has to be speaking of Jesus. And you remember what the angels sang when Jesus was born. They sang about goodwill and peace toward men, right? Peace toward men. So this was announcing the birth of Christ, who is the Prince of Peace. Of course, the word peace, shalom in Hebrew, means not just absence of conflict. It's bigger than that. It refers to well-being, total well-being. So this profile, if you put all those up, a descendant of David, he's going to be divine, he's going to do this, and then he's going to have a growing kingdom that is going to be eternal. This is something that is much greater than what we're seeing around us. This is in the future. It's a promise. And it's not just an ordinary human being, something greater than that. So if they really read that and thought seriously about the wording of this and didn't just take it as sort of hyperbole, that is exaggeration, they would realize that there's something going on here. This is a Messiah of a kind of person that we just haven't seen before.
It's clear, too, that when God deals with his people, he's not always dealing in the short term. This is not a sprint. God is seeing the big picture. It's a marathon. God wants us to get to the finish. Whether we get there today or tomorrow or the next day is not really the point because there are big issues in the great controversy. God sees the entire canvas. We may see just a little bit of it. So Tuesday, the rod of God's anger. I want to see if you can take these next 3 minutes and talk with us about this. It's a certain something that some people find a little incongruous. God is love, But we want to talk about this. Well, it's justice, I guess. God's people were guilty of tremendous sins. We deal with this on Tuesday. The rod of God's anger. How are we to look at that?
In the New Testament, for example, in the book of Hebrews, it makes it very clear that God disciplines those whom he loves. And we see that, for example, in Leviticus chapter 26, the blessings and curses. If the people go wrong and they do not cooperate with him, he will discipline them. But it's for a redemptive purpose. And the discipline gets stronger and stronger, as we see in what happened to the Israelites when they were being led through the wilderness. When they were faithless and they rebelled against God, he disciplined them. When they did it the next time, they got a more serious discipline. So they should learn from their past mistakes. Otherwise, God ratchets up the pressure. I mean, if you've got a donkey that's not listening to you and you tap it on the head, that doesn't work. Okay, next time you may hit it with a piece of wood. If that doesn't work, maybe next time a tuba fork. Walk. Got his attention, okay? Well, that's what God is doing. He's trying to get people's attention. So there's this idea of redemptive discipline is one kind of suffering that God allows for a purpose, to make people wake up. Wakey, wakey time, okay? But then there's another kind of discipline, which is, well, this is beyond discipline. It's really punishment. And that is, for example, later on in Isaiah, we're going to see that God wiped out 185,000 Assyrian soldiers who were under the command of King Sennacherib. They were trying to take Jerusalem and destroy the place. And God wiped all those people out. This is not discipline. This is destruction. And why was the destruction? It is because this was an oppressor. And the only way God could lovingly save those whom he was trying to save was through destroying the oppressor. So if anyone chooses to be an oppressor against God and against his people, that is a dangerous occupation. That is an occupational hazard. You may run afoul of God's punishment and nailing you so that you don't hurt any more God's people. So those are a couple of things. And then finally, in Revelation 20, of course, we get the destruction of all sins so that the universe can be purified. And God is going to make sure that everyone has a choice, but ultimately, for the sake of his love for the whole universe, those who do not accept his love will forfeit that protection of his love, and they will take the consequences.
What we see at the bottom of Tuesday, I'll just go back here. What we see here, as seen through all the Bible, is the reality of free will. God made humans free. He had to, otherwise we could never truly love him. And freedom involves the option to do wrong. The option to do wrong. God in his mercy and his goodness does all he can to direct us back on to the right track, because there are big issues involved. Eternity is worth being part of. It's not something anybody wants to miss out on or should miss out on. God understands that better than anyone. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Sabbath School on It Is Written.
More and more people are watching It Is Written TV. They're watching their favorite It Is Written programs, listening to inspiring sermon series, and much more. They're watching them here, here, and even here. See for yourself why people are turning to It Is Written TV to watch their favorite Christian programs live and on demand. Watch It Is Written TV for free anytime on Roku, Apple TV, and at itiswritten.tv.
Welcome back to Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written, with our very special guest, Dr. Roy Gain, who is the author of this quarter's quarterly on the subject of Isaiah. Dr. Gain is a professor in Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern languages at the Theological Seminary at Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Lesson 5, The Noble Prince of Peace. We're looking at some of these really fascinating, loved, and well-known chapters or portions of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 11, there shall come forth a root out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. A root and a branch. Now, I think we know who we're talking about here, but why do you think Isaiah used this sort of language, Dr. Gain? And what were the points that he was trying to make? He wants to clearly fix our heart on the scriptures and connect us with the heart of God. Why is he doing it like this? What's he saying?
Well, first of all, this is the third major messianic prophecy in the book of Isaiah. The first was in 7 with the promise of Emmanuel, God is with us. The second was in chapter 9, where we have the unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and his name shall be called. And he there in chapter 9 is identified as coming from the line of David. So here we have in Isaiah 11, verse 1, there will come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. Now, why doesn't it say there will come forth a shoot from the stump of David? It says Jesse. And the point is that David was the son of Jesse. And so what this is saying is there's going to be another one, and we find out that he's going to be a ruler, a just ruler, who is going to be a new David, not just a new son of David. He's going to be like a new David. And so he's coming from that line. He's going to be descended from Jesse and from David. But then later on down below here, we find out that he's also the root. How could he be both? We find that referring to Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation. He's both the root and the offspring of David. And here he is in verse 10, the root of Jesse. How can he be the root of Jesse and also come from Jesse? That's a contradiction in terms. We call that an oxymoron, right? The oxymoron. Okay, but when there's only one person that could possibly be. And that correlates also with the prophecy in chapter 9, where we have this, unto us a son is born, his name shall be called Everlasting Father. How could he be the Father and also the Son? That only applies to Jesus Christ, because in the Bible, he is the creator. In John chapter 1, in Hebrews chapter 1, the world and everyone in it, everybody is created from him. The genealogy in Luke, at the end of Luke chapter 3, it says that Adam was the son of God. Okay, so Christ is God, the member of the Godhead who was the creator. All three members of the Godhead involved in creation, but certainly Christ was there as the creator. That's why he can be called the Father. He is the origin. He is the root. And from him came forth Adam and everyone else. But then on the other hand, Christ comes and he's born into a human family. So this is the only personality in history, in the universe, that we know about, certainly, that has done this, is Jesus Christ. He is the creator. He has a preexistence. It says in Micah 5, verse 2, his goings are from of old. That is, he was around a long time before, from eternity, and yet he comes into a human family. Now, this really touches on the dynamics of why Jesus is the only one who could come to save us. Why is it? Have you asked the question, why is it that an angel couldn't have died for us? Why did it have to be Christ? It had to be a member of the Godhead because not only is he equal to the law that human beings have broken, that is a factor, but the other big factor is he is the creator. He's the creator who made all of us. So we were all in him. So Adam was the son of God, as if God was his ancestor. Now in Hebrews chapter 7, Paul, I believe, is the author of Hebrews. Paul refers to Levi being in the loins of his ancestor, Abraham. So whatever Abraham did, he represented all of his descendants, including the tribe of Levi, from whom the priests came. And Paul makes a point out of that. Now, if that thinking is carried through to this concept of Christ in relation to us, then we as the human race, we're all in him because he is the what? The everlasting Father. We think of Christ having his Father, and on earth he spoke of his Father being in heaven. But in relation to us, Christ is also our Father. And so we were all in him. So whatever he does, he can represent all of us, just like whatever Abraham did represented all of his line of descendants. That's why Christ can die for the whole human race, because he represents the whole human race.
Isaiah changes gear when we get to Thursday's lesson, that you take us over to Isaiah chapter 12 here, and he sort of changes gear. At least it would appear that he does. Chapter 12 is short, just 6 verses. It's a psalm. And in that day you shall say, O Lord, I will praise you. Though you are angry with me, your anger is turned away, and you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord Jehovah is my strength and my song. He is also become my salvation. That sounds reminiscent of the song we read back in the book of Exodus. So talk to me about, oh yes, and of course this is mentioned here, Talk to me about this seeming shift and why Isaiah is easing into this language in this place. What's the message for us here?
So here, this is really wrapping up the first part of the book of Isaiah with a song, which is wonderful. It's a song of deliverance, a song of praise, praising God for salvation. It's ending this whole section with an upbeat, which is a wonderful thing. Yes, God has lots of warning. He has rebuke, reproof. He has the covenant lawsuit where the people are condemned, all of those things. But yet, when it all comes out to the end, there is something good at the end. There is this celebration of praise. And it really reminds us also, looking back with 2020 hindsight, knowing the New Testament, reminds us of the Song of Moses and the Lamb in Revelation chapter 15, a song of deliverance with regard to the whole plan of salvation itself. So this is a wonderful thing that God is ending this. We have comfort here. We have comfort. And the next, the section of Isaiah beginning in chapter 40, after the first 39 chapters, really have a lot about judgment and warning and all those kind of things. Chapters 40 and following have a tremendous amount of comfort. In fact, they begin in Isaiah 40, verse 1. Nahmu. Nahmu ami yomer Elohechem. Davru alev Yerushalayim v'kiru alecha. Comfort, comfort, says my God. See, comfort. And that's the word that is showing up here in this passage of comfort. By the way, speaking of the artistic, musical flow of Isaiah, you heard what I said there about 40 verse 1 about the comfort. Nahmu. Nahmu ami yomer Elohechem. So you have short, short, long. It's like what we find in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum. So we have this rhythm going on. And we have that rhythm in this poetry of chapter 12. In fact, a great deal of Isaiah is, in fact, poetry. Certainly from 40 to the end of the book is poetry. And a lot of the earlier chapters also, this rhythm, which can be sung. And that is intended for us to be able to celebrate.
Friday, there's a fantastic discussion question. And we could discuss this all day, but I'm going to mention this to you. As we saw in Isaiah 11, the Lord presented both comings of Christ in one picture. This can help explain, at least somewhat, why some of the Jews did not accept Christ at his first coming, because they expected him to do the things that will happen only at the second coming. What does this tell us about how important it is that we have a proper understanding of the nature of Christ's advent? So, yes, that's very important, but I'm sure many, many, many of us, I'm saying Christians, have looked at this situation and marveled that Jewish people are able to read those prophecies and miss what we see so clearly. Okay, there are very obvious some reasons for that. But this is an interesting wrinkle, I think, that it wouldn't have been difficult for somebody to say, okay, we're talking about later and not sooner. It's going to happen later and not sooner. We're not looking at the here and now, so we might be looking past some things and ignoring some things. We're looking down for something that's going to happen later. So this isn't it. This is a fascinating, perhaps a fascinating reason why many people, many Jewish people, look beyond the first coming to something that's happening at a later time. What are your thoughts?
That's right. And in chapter 11, verse 6, it says, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and so on and so forth. Predators and their prey are in peace. And this is really, you could call it hyperbole, okay? Or you could say that this is looking forward to a new heavens and a new earth where things are all going to be different. So here is really looking very much ahead into the future. We find also in Isaiah 65, we find some remarkable prophecies. Isaiah 65, for example, I think it's in verse 20. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old. The sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. So this is pointing to long life in a future better time. And you have a number of things going on here, as well as in verse 25, it says, the wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. What is this? In the new heavens and the new earth, people are only going to be living 100 years old? What's going on here? Well, it seems to be blending future events into an ideal future. And it's really, when you think about it, this kind of prophecy is when you're a long way back. Say when you're driving across eastern Colorado, you're coming from the plains, you go across Nebraska, which is very flat, and you go into Colorado and it's flat. And then all of a sudden, way off in the distance, you can see the Rocky Mountains. Okay, now you can't differentiate very much the depth perception in that far distance, what's going on there. It's just sort of like a duck. There it is. And that's the way these things are. They're looking into a future, but not really differentiating so much within that time frame in the future, what is going to happen. Now, you say, what about the Jewish people? It looks like they would have a good reason to say that, well, yes, we should have a Messiah. He's going to deliver us from the Romans. He's going to do these things, and it's all going to be over. And forget. But wait a minute. What about the suffering servant boy in Isaiah 53? See, Isaiah progressively leads us into a greater understanding of the nature of Christ's coming, his first coming, so that there is humility, vulnerability, suffering, and even degrading death. And as we look at the profiles of these messianic prophecies, we can see the relationships between them and how it really has to be the same person who is Christ. So you have to look at the whole thing together, and then you get it. But apparently that's not what they were doing, because that wasn't part of their box. They really didn't want to be thinking about the suffering of the Son. And how could God suffer? So their idea of a victorious deity is one who does not suffer, who is always victorious. So yes, it would have been difficult, but it could be possible if you take the whole big picture, all of the texts together.
It's a magnificent book, the book of Isaiah, 66 chapters. Isaiah has been referred to many times as the gospel prophet. I'm blessed. We're blessed to have you sharing your scholarship and your insights. Dr. Roy Gain from Andrews University Theological Seminary, thank you very much. Looking forward to doing this sometime again soon.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me today, or us today. By the way, if you don't have this, the book of Isaiah, the companion book to go along with the quarterly, I'd encourage you to get it. This will take you deeper in Isaiah and bless your understanding of this remarkable book. You can visit us at itiswritten.shop, and you can find it there 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Thanks for being here. We'll do this again next week, lesson 6 next time around. It's going to be as good as this one was. As a matter of fact, I can tell you the title is Playing God. Join me and Dr. Gain then for more Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written.